Today is Tuesday, August 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up,
heavy presence of the police and special forces, and everything is aimed at scaring off any potential demonstrators.
Also ahead, we get the details on a new U.S. policy regarding immigration, and we hear some promising news about Ebola. It's all on today's International Edition. For nearly a month, tens of thousands of people have protested in Russia, and the growing number of political rallies are drawing many young people who until now had largely ignored politics. VOA's Yulia Savchenko is in Moscow and reporting on the developments there. She spoke earlier in the day with my colleague, Kate Pound Dawson.
Yes, so the formal trigger of these protests were the city's election commission rejection of several opposition candidates' application to run in a September 8th vote for the Moscow City Duma. And it's a small election, but at the same time, it created all this uncertainty and it created unrest. The demonstrations started in early July, and in the weeks past, they transformed into a wider protest against the lack of democratic freedoms, including electoral freedoms, and against police brutality as well. I must say that every Saturday, now the downtown of Moscow looks like an epicenter of military action. Heavy presence of the police and special forces, and everything is aimed at scaring off any potential demonstrators who might be considering joining the rally. And somewhat it works. I spoke to many people who are while supporting the cause and the calls for to free political prisoners and allow free elections are not prepared to take to the streets, especially considering the fact that most of the rallies here in Moscow are unsanctioned, which kind of unties the hands of law enforcement who detain people with little reason and increased brutality. Right now, the number of detained at the rallies is more than 2,000. And the most recent demonstrations that was actually sanctioned by the Moscow authorities brought about 50,000 people to the streets, and that was the biggest protest. But many of the people who showed up were saying that they felt a little safer since they were coming to a sanctioned rally. That did not stop the crackdown, though. Around 150 people were detained, and some parts of the downtown were full of police cordons, and thus it was creating even more confusion among those who have not even heard about protests.
Has the Kremlin said anything about what's going on? What has been the reaction at the highest levels?
You know, it is quite interesting because we have not had any reaction from Vladimir Putin. The president actually has been doing a lot of things in the south of the country, and he's been talking to the victims of the fires, of the forest fires, and he's kind of been showing his support to the people outside Moscow, but he has not said anything whatsoever about the protests in Moscow. He never addressed demonstrators. And there are certain speculations among the observers and among analysts that actually Vladimir Putin approved this crackdown, but we don't have any official source saying that. And we have very little official reaction so far. The highest official reaction we have been getting about the protests were from the mayor of Moscow, Sobyanin, and he has been approving the police crackdown, and he was just saying that public unrest can never be allowed in the capital of Russia.
Do analysts there and activist groups there think that the protests are going to continue for a while? Is this a growing movement, or is there an expectation that they'll start to taper off?
Well, actually, analysts I've spoken to and observers expect that the rallies will continue into the fall and will grow in size, in fact. First of all, because the causes are growing. Lawlessness and police brutality made people very angry and aware of what they call the lawlessness of the whole system. So a lot of young people are now taking to the streets. We spoke to some of them, and the general mood is we're young, we're many, and we want to live in a different country. But at the same time, one cannot discount potential intensification of the crackdown. Russian authorities are not prepared to give up, and the recent events showcase that the power holders will not shy away from the so-called militarized response.
That was correspondent Yulia Savchenko in Moscow speaking with VOA's Kate Pound Dawson. Well, Almazbek Atambayev, Kyrgyzstan's former president, has been charged with plotting to overthrow the government and murder. Authorities arrested Atambayev during a raid on his house last Thursday after an attempt to take him into custody a day earlier turned violent when his supporters clashed with police. Atambayev had been wanted for questioning over a corruption case. Atambayev's arrest could escalate a lingering feud with his hand-picked successor, Sooronbay Jeenbekov, which could plunge the Central Asian country and ex-Soviet republic into a political crisis. Atambayev served as Kyrgyzstan's president between 2011 and 2017. Among the top stories in the world, South Korea is feeling new pressure from both North Korea and the U.S. over stalled nuclear weapons talks. Cameroon threatens journalists it says are not being patriotic, and many journalists say it is becoming impossible to work there. Search crews in Malaysia have found the body of a 15-year-old French-Irish girl who went missing more than a week ago. And Libyan officials say fighting over Tripoli resumes after a two-day ceasefire during the Eid al-Adha holiday. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition. Well, President Donald Trump's administration has announced a new policy that could impede immigrants already in the U.S. from obtaining permanent residency or citizenship if they use public benefits to pay for health care, housing, or food. Eleni Barros covers immigration issues for VOA. She joins us now on the phone to explain the new policy and its implications. Thank you for joining us, Eleni.
Thanks for having me.
Well, can you start by telling us what this new policy, what exactly entails?
So it's a new rule, a new interpretation of the public charge law that has been in the books for quite some time. So under the new rule, the financial well-being of an immigrant who are in the United States legally on temporary visas will be more heavily scrutinized when they seek a green card, which is the way to stay legally here, you know, permanent residency. So immigration officials will consider an immigrant's age, health, family status, assets, resources, financial status, and education. And officials will be giving a broader discretion to determine whether or not that immigrant is likely to use a public service, a public benefit. And with that determination, they can deny them the green card and eventually order them to leave the country. And if they don't, then people can be put on removal proceedings and eventually deportation.
Well, what are the administration's reasons for making this change?
So the Trump administration, they're big in defending that idea that the United States should welcome immigrants based only on their merit that they demonstrate, right? So Ken Cuccinelli, who is the acting director of the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services, he said in a press conference that the rule would allow the government to insist that immigrants who come to the country were self-sufficient and would not be a drain to society. So that's basically their reasoning. But they did say that the new rule would not apply to people who already have green cards, to certain members of the military, to refugees, asylum seekers, or pregnant women and children.
Now, what do the immigration advocates have to say about this?
It's a complex regulation, right? It's about 900 pages, I believe, and it is scheduling to go into effect, in fact, in 60 days. So advocates have described as a cruel policy, and they said that it's already causing immigrants to abandon housing and medical benefits because they were concerned about the impact that using those services might have on their immigration status or status on someone in their family, which is not the case. So a few organizations, they got together, and they yesterday in the press conference, they told reporters that they will take this to court.
Also, just real quickly, Eleni, what percentage of immigrants are believed to be on these types of programs?
So one thing we have to say is that when you are an immigrant, when you have some sort of visa, you do not qualify for federal benefits. You might qualify for state benefits in some states of the United States. When you have your green card, you can only apply for certain federal benefits after 5 years of having a green card, unless something tragic happens in your life, like a car accident, or somehow you were unable to perform, you know, any sort of work. So an Associated Press analysis of the census data actually showed that low-income immigrants who are non-citizens and use Medicaid and food aid, for instance, they use at a lower rate than low-income U.S.-born adults. So non-citizens immigrants are about 6.5% of those participating in Medicaid, for instance, and they are 8.8% of those receiving food assistance.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for that information. I appreciate it. That was VOA's Eleni Barros speaking with me by phone. Well, the Trump administration took steps yesterday to weaken the U.S. Endangered Species Act, prompting some state attorneys general and conservation groups to threaten legal action to protect at-risk species. The 1970s-era act is credited with bringing back the brink of extinction species such as bald eagles, gray whales, and grizzly bears. However, the law has long been a source of frustration for drilling and mining companies and other industries because new listings can put vast areas of land off limits to development. The weakening of the act's protections is one of many moves by U.S. President Donald Trump to roll back regulations to increase oil, gas, and coal production, as well as ranching and logging on federal land. My colleague Lori London spoke with Noah Greenwald, Endangered Species Director with the Center for Biological Diversity, about this changing policy.
So there are three rules, the first of which applies to listing of species as threatened or endangered and designation of critical habitat for them. And under that rule, it allows, maybe even requires, Fish and Wildlife Service and National Marine Fisheries Service to consider the economic impacts of listing a species as threatened or endangered. And this is something that Congress had specifically precluded. They had said these decisions about the very survival of species should be limited just to the science. You know, is the species at risk of extinction or not, without consideration of economic factors? And now those economic factors will be considered, which is really unfortunate. And then for critical habitat, the rule makes it a lot less likely that species will get designated critical habitat. And specifically, they say that if the species isn't threatened by direct habitat destruction, then they won't designate critical habitat. So, for example, species threatened by climate change, they wouldn't designate critical habitat, even though those species clearly need it. It also makes it harder to designate critical habitat in areas where species currently aren't found, which, again, is really bad for species threatened by climate change, because you may need to, you know, for example, if you're a species that live at the beach, you know, you may need protection of habitat inland, factoring in the fact that you're a species that's going to need to move.
So basically what you're saying is that going forward, the Endangered Species Act will not provide the same protections that it has for many of our threatened species. Is that what you're saying?
Very much so. Some of the other things it does, it changes how critical habitat for species that are listed will be protected by defining what qualifies as adverse modification of critical habitat. And it limits that only to projects that threaten the entirety of a species' critical habitat. So you can picture, you know, a species that's got a pretty wide distribution but is still very threatened, like the northern spotted owl, for example. There's no one single logging project that's going to affect the whole of its critical habitat, which is more than 9 million acres. So it allows for this death by a thousand cuts scenario.
Is this a done deal, or does this need to go through Congress?
This is a done deal. We're going to challenge it in court for sure, but it does not need congressional approval. I mean, these are executive branch. The Trump administration can put rules in place that implement laws that were passed by Congress. And so that's what they've done here. And our only recourse is to go to court. There's a lot of procedural problems with the way these rules were put in place. For one thing, they went through a lot of changes. They got worse between the proposed rule and the final rule, so the American public hasn't had a chance to comment on the rules as they stand, as well as, you know, they did a categorical exclusion under the National Environmental Policy Act. They didn't actually evaluate the impact of these rule changes on the environment. We're hopeful that we'll be able to get a court to stop these rules from going into place.
What do you think their reasoning behind this is?
I mean, I think this is just a handout to their campaign contributors in industry. This doesn't benefit endangered species. It doesn't benefit the American people. It only, who, you know, by the way, broadly support protection of endangered species and recognize the importance of preventing extinction. This just benefits, you know, their buddies in the oil and gas industry or the big agriculture or other industries that see, you know, protections for endangered species as threatening short-term profit.
That was Noah Greenwald, Endangered Species Director with the Center for Biological Diversity, speaking with International Edition's Lori London. Well, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, has called for an investigation into what she says is the use of banned tactics by Hong Kong police to quell anti-government demonstrations. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet is voicing concern about the escalating violence in Hong Kong and worries about it spiraling out of control. She is urging protesters to express their grievances peacefully and not to resort to violence or the destruction of property. Bachelet, however, is urging Hong Kong authorities to refrain from hard-nosed tactics that violate people's rights of freedom of expression and peaceful assembly, and which are likely to cause civilian casualties. Her spokesman, Rupert Colville, says the High Commissioner is alarmed by the methods used by the security forces that are both dangerous and forbidden.
OHCHR has reviewed credible evidence of law enforcement officials employing less lethal weapons in ways that are prohibited by international norms and standards. For example, officials can be seen firing tear gas canisters into crowded enclosed areas and directly at individual protesters on multiple occasions, creating a considerable risk of death or serious injury.
Colville says there are clear guidelines on how supposed non-lethal weapons such as tear gas, batons, and rubber bullets should be used.
Law enforcement officials should only employ tear gas to disperse crowds as a last resort when widespread violence creates an imminent threat of serious injury or damage to property. And in this situation, the canisters must be fired at a high angle to create indirect fire.
The UN Human Rights Office is calling on Hong Kong authorities to investigate these incidents immediately and ensure security personnel comply with the rules of engagement. It warns excessive use of force will only inflame tensions and worsen the situation. Rights Chief Bachelet is also urging all sides to resolve the situation through calm, meaningful dialogue. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you, Lisa. You're listening to VOA's International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists say that the planets of our solar system were formed about 4.5 billion years ago. Soon afterwards, the Earth and the Moon became a veritable shooting gallery as they were bombarded with waves of comets, asteroids, and even protoplanets that flowed past them. New research led by geologist Stephen Moisish of the University of Colorado at Boulder suggests the extensive bombardment was caused by a solar system-altering event 4.48 billion years ago. The event, called the Giant Planet Migration, was when the solar system's largest planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, for some still unknown reason, began to move from their positions near the Sun to their present positions in the outer solar system. Moisish and his team found evidence that debris was scattered, with some of it crashing into Earth and its then young moon as the big planets migrated. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The World Health Organization says two new treatments are vastly extending the lives of those stricken with Ebola in the eastern part of the DRC. The drugs are REGN-EB3 and MAB-114. A WHO spokesman says the new treatments work best when combined with good surveillance and good infection prevention controls. Scientists say it is not likely that the disease will be eradicated from its forest habitat, but they say the chances of survival are highest when those stricken seek help within the first 3 days of exposure to the disease. On the other hand, there is a nearly 90% mortality rate for those who are not treated or who come late. The year-old Ebola outbreak in the DRC has killed at least 1,900 people. Health experts are hopeful the new treatments will reduce the number of those dying from the virus. Well, one of the consequences of Venezuela's economic collapse is that there many women aren't able to afford basic health services, and even things like sanitary napkins are now increasingly out of reach for many women. From Caracas, Adriana Nunez has this report narrated by Christina Casiedo Smith.
All kinds of basics, from food to medicine and even sanitary napkins, are becoming increasingly out of reach for Venezuelans because of rampant hyperinflation. Sanitary napkins can be bought on the black market, but are unaffordable for many women. So for now, they do what they can.
We use an old sheet and cotton. I cut it into pieces, and I also use a plastic bag.
Desire lives in a house full of women who do the same thing during their period.
I use a plastic bag and pieces of fabric.
Raquel Perez, a mother of three, says she has not used a store-bought sanitary napkin in 2 years.
It is very expensive and I can't afford it. We don't make enough money. If we buy sanitary napkins, we don't have money to buy diapers. I prefer buying diapers.
Human rights advocate Luisa Kislinger says this shortage is not only unsanitary, but it keeps women from living a normal life during their period.
That prevents many women, girls, and adolescents during those days to take part in their daily activities, like going to school or work.
It's not just health products. The prices of everything from food to gasoline rose 33% in July alone. And for most Venezuelans, living without has become a way of life. For Adriana Núñez Rabascal in Caracas, Cristina Caicedo Smith, VOA News.
In Australia, the police and members of the public today subdued a knife-wielding man in Sydney. The 21-year-old man is suspected of slaying a woman in a nearby apartment before going on the rampage in the city's downtown area. Witnesses say the man was yelling Allahu Akbar and stabbed one woman in the back before several people pinned him down. The South Wales State Police Commissioner says the incident has not been categorized as an act of terrorism, though that could change as the investigation continues. So far, authorities say the man seems to be acting alone, though he was carrying a flash drive with information on terrorist attacks in New Zealand and other countries. The police say the suspect, who has a history of mental health issues, has been charged with homicide. Well, you've been listening to VOA's International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Nadia Taha, and our engineer, Thomas Blondet. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll have an in-depth discussion on child marriage and how girls are valued around the world. Married teenage girls are often physically abused and forced into lives of chores and childbearing. The Worth of a Girl on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, thank you for listening to Border Crossings with Larry London. This month, Border Crossings is giving away a really cool Voice of America t-shirt. Hooray! If you want to win one of these awesome shirts, all you have to do is make a song request.